It gives me, as a technically oriented person, a certain degree of satisfaction to tell you that I look on a business enterprise as a system. It's not linear. It's not conservative of energy, certainly, and it's not otherwise well-behaved. But it's a system nonetheless. In its most basic form, it's a mechanism for expanding stockholders' wealth through dividends or capital gains. Those more technical in their outlook may see it as a mechanism for converting some form of raw material into saleable products via the use of human labor. Many employees, unfortunately, see a business as a system for extracting a maximum of work from them in return for a minimal reward. If a person has that view, it's fair to say that he hasn't fully advanced into management status. The manager's view is, or should be, that a business is a system in which he twiddles some of the knobs to increase the stockholder's wealth and is himself rewarded in some fair proportion to his success as a system operator. But let's face it, this view is not universal, for there are opportunists as well as unquestioning stooges at most levels in every corporation or institution. The business system of a typical company has major components. May I have the first figure, please? Suborganizations, which are those shown in the figure, even if known in your company by other names. I believe general management is the one in the lower right-hand corner. Most people would expect to see the organizational blocks connected into an organizational chart that is supposed to be, at least, an authority flowchart. I don't prefer to do this, since in general, the functioning of the business system has little to do with the organizational structure. The structure may be the result of personalities, geography, or other past history. A product flow chart, which is another thing again, would connect the organizational entities in different ways from a cash flow chart. What counts most, I think, are the necessary functions in the system. Engineering is only one, and in many firms, a non-critical function, not in the highly technology-oriented firm, but I know of many of them. Accordingly, I'll propose that it's essential to the future of the engineer and engineering manager that he know considerable about each of the other major functions. It's equally important that he know how the various functions interact in his own company, both the formal interactions and the informal ones. Where management establishes formal lines of communication via an organization chart, these are always inadequate to the total system's needs, and the astute manager must supplement his formal interactions with other essential informal contacts. I don't plan to go further to describe the dynamics of such a business system. That's a talk for another day or year or decade. But I will share with you some Cracker Barrel philosophy about business areas that you, as engineering managers or candidates for same, should learn more about to do your jobs better. What's an engineering manager? As with most other titles, engineering manager is a catch-all. In very small firms, it may be the employee who is not a salesman. In large ones, it encompasses the direction of research, development, manufacturing, or technology. But it usually refers to an individual who got his own start as an engineer, and a man who therefore is able to talk to engineers. Put that in quotes. An engineering manager, the next slide please, is responsible for technical direction, financial accountability, decision making, organization, communication, planning, and personnel management. Of these, only one, technical direction, isn't common to all managers at all levels. The engineering manager is unique in that he brings to his managerial job a superb background in self-discipline, in logical thinking, in practical compromise, and maybe even a little applied mathematics. Too bad that in his attempts to emulate managers arriving via other disciplines, or in some cases no discipline at all, he often casts aside qualities and methods which, properly applied in his manager status, can very much enhance his value to his firm. That seems to be par for the course. There are biases everywhere. A top manager who is himself an engineer will promote other engineers. A top man from public accountancy will draw others cast in his own image. As reported recently by Business Week, the day of the engineer in top management seems to be passing. The engineer in middle management seeking full elevation may need to hide his engineer-ness. More to the point, he must bring forth those other skills and abilities which mark a top manager as something of a Renaissance man. Some of these, remarkably few of them, demand formal education. Although the colleges do continue to improve their business curricula, business is still mostly learned on the job. Many managerial qualities have to do with one's point of view, and others are totally experiential. Salary versus experience curves published recently in IEEE Spectrum, like those everywhere else, show that individuals identifying as engineers mostly start high and hit plateaus in earning power after 10 to 15 years, at which point the salary curves for management-identified individuals have overtaken those of engineers and are still climbing. This is probably a very eloquent argument for the value of business experience. It suggests that to put engineers back into the executive suites, the engineering manager must get business experience on the job. And such experience, from my observations, is available in most firms. However, many engineering managers and engineers aren't really interested in it, especially where one's own manager is an engineer. A person may be effectively isolated or even actively discouraged from taking a business orientation in his work. Getting on the job business experience, if one is motivated, is usually easy enough. In many technical firms, management long ago anticipated the engineer's traditional avoidance of business concerns and set up staff functions to handle business routine. As a result, in many firms, the true business challenges are never properly addressed, and the war cry is, business as usual! But the recent recession shook the foundations of more than one heretofore high-flying company, bringing renewed attention to the opportunities available only through inspired business management. Many engineering managers are now being drawn into business affairs for the first time, liking it, and what's more, making great contributions. The new challenges are occasionally given additional spice through stock options or profit sharing, but for some reason, loss sharing has never caught on as a motivator. A thread which winds through all of business management is decision-making. Not that the engineering manager doesn't have to do this also, but generally he operates from somewhat better data and has a lower exposure if decision is a bad one. Business decision-making in general, and much of it is done in general, is an art for which the engineering manager is usually well-prepared if he knows and uses some simple but logical approaches. Many business people are devoted to a top-of-the-head or a seat-of-the-pants approach. They're really the same thing. Those people may have achieved their success that way, and when successful, who's there to challenge them? When unsuccessful, they may be forced to pull up stakes and move on, but surprisingly often, they make out even better because of the lessons they've learned at someone else's expense. Very seldom are business managers challenged by higher management or a board of directors for their lack of an analytical approach. A few simple charts and tables presented at the height of a decision meeting will confuse almost anyone long enough to head them off at the pass. Superficial analytical approaches are great for show-stopping, but we can only hope that the moment of truth arrives before the day of disaster. At the opposite end of the spectrum from those total pragmatists, we find the super-analytical decision-making enthusiasts among businessmen. Some of these folks, many of whom admire all technology, even if they don't understand it, were among the first to promote the total management information system, up-to-the-minute corporate data for the busy top executive. The failure of these glorious and gloriously expensive schemes has turned off some of the past enthusiasts and has returned them to the seat-of-the-pants school. The truly analytical business managers, on the other hand, have as a very important skill the ability to select wisely just how analytical one should get in a particular situation. Good engineers and good engineering managers also have such ability. Sometimes it's best to go to the books, sometimes just go get the hacksaw. Although the most frequently used tools of the analytical decision maker are not very extensive or very complicated, many engineers, as well as business people, are not really familiar with them. An engineering manager who's been in a big project may have had contact with PERT or critical path scheduling, but usually is a victim of it, so that he may not have a natural attraction to it. It's different when you're setting up the schedules. The operations research people, and that's often a category in companies set aside somewhere in the staff, I think in self-justification often try to make analytical decision-making appear very complex so that only they can do it. And like many engineers, OR people often have solutions in search of a problem. A favorite OR technique is linear programming, which is fine if the problem is, or is reducible to, a set of linear algebraic equations and boundary conditions. If the problem is really not reducible to linear form, applying linear programming may just be plain wrong. And nonlinear programming, which encompasses just about any optimization problem which isn't linear, has relatively few directly solvable cases. Some businesses have been outstandingly successful with highly analytical business decision-making and optimization. For example, the petroleum industry. Using linear programming to a very heavy degree, they produce bulk products from bulk raw materials with sources, refineries, and users scattered over the globe. They need to optimize that system. These analytical methods that they use have become an essential part of their business. The hooker is, however, that many of these petroleum industry decisions are rather routine, unlike those that some of you may have to face. Most likely, your own business has more frequent uncertainties and more intangibles than the oil business. How to get specific, to use your logical engineer's approach on intangibles, or at most, semi-tangibles, this is a basic business problem. Let's look at a few simple but useful approaches. My first suggestion may sound trite, but it's often helpful in dealing with problems you can't really define well. Try to use a figure or curve to illustrate the relationships which will really define the problem. And this is where you start mixing money and gigahertz, for example. They aren't in the same dimension, but by God, you better make them so. Often decisions will come into much clearer focus when it's illustrated in this way. May I have the next figure, please? Take, for example, the development of a wholly new product. Is it a wise thing to develop such a product or not? Now, you might, and this is only for the strong of heart, you might illustrate the progress toward product profit by sketching the various costs and times involved in the stages which you'll have to go through. If you're organized in a functional way, you may never do it this way because what you'll be doing is dividing some of your research and some of your engineering and manufacturing, tooling, etc., dollars to do this product. And the product may never get a clean-cut evaluation so that it can financially stand on its own. This is a most revealing thing, and the fact that we have to really integrate all the minuses so that when we come to the point where net loss switches to net profit, we may have an awful lot of money invested, and that's important. It's often an eye-opener to see how far you've got to go before you'll recoup costs with a new product. RCA, you may recall, went about $80 million in the hole before starting to sell color TV sets. Many management decisions involve a choice between two or more alternatives. The problem here is to be objective, particularly when you have a gut feeling that one alternative is really best. Where there are only two or three choices, one approach is to list all the advantages of each alternative, then compare. The trick is to become, at least temporarily, a true advocate for each of the possibilities in turn. But you may need to go back around the loop so as to make sure that you rate all of them on the basis of each other's advantages. Often this approach leads to an otherwise unobserved benefit in one alternative, but it may serve to reinforce your first intuitive choice. When a choice between alternatives is a narrow one, and there may be many to choose from, you can steal a trick from management consultants, who charge quite a bit for this service, by the way, and set up what many people call a matrix. Now, the purists won't call it a matrix because it doesn't transform and so on. But what you do is you draw an array of boxes. Each row of the array represents an attribute of the things you are selecting. Each column represents one of the alternatives. May I have the next figure, please? The totals are the sums from the various columns. I'll make no comments, but this is the choice of the blonde with the large bosom seems to be a common one. And you'll notice that that's what we've arrived at, whether we intended it or not. Your first step is to determine how to measure each attribute. Keep in mind that the simplest final step is to sum all the measures in a column. If you're going to multiply them and take the logarithms, that complicates things and makes you liable to make mistakes. Use simple tests for weighting. Is so much of one attribute equal to a certain amount of another, etc.? You may have to be a bit arbitrary, but be as logical as you possibly can be. If you have done your work well, measuring each of the choices against the attributes is straightforward. Summing a score for each is also simple. Finally, you may end up with one choice which clearly stands out, as it does in this case. That's good. If you do not, first eliminate the sure losers and then get down to finer details. If you can develop a decided preference for one alternative, your decision has now been accomplished. The method has essentially no scientific justification, but it works, because what you do is take a large decision and break it down into many smaller ones. The figure illustrates one major decision which faces most managers at some point in their career. Most highly mathematical optimization techniques are suitable for a relatively narrow range of problems and suitable only after much simplification of the real problem has taken place. Some that you may use are really nothing more than applying optimization to engineering design problems, perhaps with some costs and times factored in with appropriate weights. But for most real-life managerial decision-making, you'll find it necessary to glue together analysis out of simple mathematics, interest compounding to show the real costs of long-range developments, straight-line approximations to weird or uncertain curves, factoring in historical data as first approximations, making linear or nonlinear extrapolations, and so on. One big problem is that you, as an engineer or engineering manager, may get only an occasional opportunity to do this sort of thing. Naturally, your progress won't be as rapid as if you did it regularly. If you need help, corporate staff people or consultants are a place to turn. But don't just dump the job in their laps if you want to retain the real decision-making responsibility. Only you will be able to make the right assumptions, and on the assumptions depends the result, just like most engineering problems. The higher you go in management, the more important will be your decision-making responsibility. It's wise to learn now how best to attack unshapely problems before you get too important and too busy. Financial concerns are probably the most time-consuming and worrisome of all business management problems. No matter what the end product may be, the bottom line of the P&L sheet is all important. Many, if not most, corporate executives, unless they themselves are accountants or finance experts, leave much corporate financial manipulation to specialists. Too often the engineer or engineering manager sees the financial aspects of business only in terms of a computer printout of his departmental budget and perhaps some proposal estimates. Top financial executives see it a bit differently. They deal with money almost as artists with modeling clay. May I have the next figure? The figure shows in much simplified form the complex balancing act on the financial system which the financial executive must perform. Of all the financial items, from my observations, the wages and facilities costs are among the least complex and the most predictable, as contrasted to the handling of loans, investments, receivables, and the like. Most firms finance their operations through a combination of expensive short-term loans, often directly from banks, less expensive, longer-term debt in the form of corporate bonds, and finally, stock issues, which are, of course, a direct share in the ownership of the business. In a large firm, the many money sources tapped require ceaseless renegotiation as the cost of borrowing money fluctuates. This activity is the most demanding task for the financial executive. A dollar saved on interest payments is just as good as a dollar of profit, maybe better. No wonder the technological niceties of your new product may fail to make any impression whatsoever. Financial manipulations cover a tremendous area. For example, the benefits from acquiring a subsidiary at a price lower than its accumulated tax-deductible losses. It's a bargain. Or issuing a so-called stock dividend, which is a mere dilution of value of other shares, but some stockholders seem to like them. The complexities of corporate law and tax law, both areas where the boundaries between good business and criminal acts are narrow and wavering ones, make finance an area sometimes best left to experts. The engineering manager certainly won't be expected to become a financial genius, though it has happened in a few instances. He may very well, however, be expected to know the rudiments of investment as it applies to the development of new products. This is, of course, critical in the development of speculative products for which there is great uncertainty in market acceptance. The entire development must be paid for out of borrowed funds or perhaps from corporate retained funds, which could earn 6% or even more if otherwise invested. Accordingly, a new product must be viewed as an investment and must compete with other investments. While firms with established product lines have developed a steady level of R&D costs for a new firm or one with major new products, the length of the development cycle can be critical. A 6-month slip in first deliveries can and often has resulted in corporate disaster, particularly with small companies. If not bankruptcy, then the dilution of ownership to some hard-nosed sources of secondary capital. Obviously, the development team plays an important role in corporate finance and must be highly aware of the time and dollar situation. Selling is everyone's business. Almost no individual in our modern society can totally avoid the role of salesman. Here for the moment, I'm speaking of the human personal influence aspects of selling. Likely as not, engineering people can take a few tips from the experienced salesman. Although most of these things are going to sound like motherhood to you, they're pertinent whether you're selling yourself, your project, or your company. Be neat in appearance. Don't dress as though you like to do your own thing, even if you do it. Treat the customer with courtesy and respect, even if he doesn't return the favor. Ability to eat a little humble pie now and then will certainly help. Be brief and to the point, not like me. Get your message across, but don't overstay your welcome. Be cheerfully persistent. Everyone has a bad day now and then, and maybe the answer won't be no the next time. Talk to your customer in his own language if you can. Don't dominate the conversation. Listen well, and he may tell you what he really wants. Avoid arguments. The satisfaction you get doesn't compensate for the loss of the sale. There's absolutely nothing technical about this personal side of selling. Think of it, if you must, as simply establishing a low-noise, low-distortion channel between yourself and the sellee. Without some impedance matching and common wavelengths, it makes a much tougher problem. Marketing, I term the impersonal side of selling because you very seldom put his warm little hand in yours. Although an engineer may never get an opportunity to actually sell his company's products, the preparation and planning phase of the selling process, which are usually termed marketing, although marketing covers a variety of goods and evils, must partially be his concerns. His principal responsibility will be to provide support to the marketing and selling forces in the form of descriptions of the product, comparative evaluations versus the competition, and even suggestions as to who to sell to and how best to contact them. Marketing style differs widely with differences in the nature of the product. Serial manufacturers must put great emphasis on widespread advertising and distribution to make sure that every 6-year-old can get his box of new chocolate crummies the day after he sees Captain Wonderful gulp it down on TV. Let's face it, another day the kid will forget the whole thing. In this type of industry, and for example in small electrical appliances, the statistics of the marketplace, its response to advertising, regional taste differences, and so on, must be carefully understood. At the other end of the scale is a defense contractor dealing with a single agency. Although his marketing risks may be equally as great, the approach here consists of proposal writing and presentation to a very limited audience. Actual involvement of the engineering team in marketing and selling will generally depend on the technical complexity of the product as seen by the buyer. A typical marketing problem for a technology-based firm, sort of in between these two extremes, and a difficult marketing problem at that, is the speculative market entry of an innovative product for an application never before satisfied by such a product. Where do we go from here, fellas? In this case, no businessman in his right mind would introduce such a product without some form of market research or testing. One of the peculiar traps of the government R&D business is that one is asked to go into business to develop and manufacture a product for which market uncertainty is extremely great. But that's why they pay you to develop it. The basic questions which marketing must answer, usually with a variety of alternatives, are: 1. How many can we sell? Most marketing experts approach this one carefully. A product may be designed to be hung around the waist of any man, woman, or child, but no marketeer would have forecast domestic sales of 200 million hula hoops. The potential market, those who conceivably could use the product, must usually be multiplied by a factor much less than 1 to arrive at an estimate of the available market, that is, those who may be expected to buy. Most firms, because of internal resource limitations, will establish even much smaller sales goals, that is, the numbers on which pricing and facilities build up and capital requirements will be based. When these sales goals are much smaller than the available market, the problem reduces mostly to one of getting the product made and sold at a profit. 2, what is the right price? This is not separable from how many we can sell, quite obviously. The right price lies somewhere between the smallest, which will produce an acceptable profit, and the largest, which the buyer is willing to pay. Usually on the latter end, I might say. The range may be large or small. Marketing men use a concept of elasticity, which relates to usually a theoretical plot of the quantity expected to be sold versus the selling price. This describes an anticipated response of the marketplace. May I have the next figure, please? A product for which changes in price can cause substantial changes in purchase quantities is said to be highly elastic. One which has relatively small change in volume with price is said to be inelastic. I'm sure that you can think of both kinds of products. For example, auto tires have low elasticity. No pun intended, really. But air travel has high elasticity, as the airlines have been proving with their vacation plans and so on. Establishing the demand versus price relationship for a product requires some form of market research, which may or may not involve test marketing, questionnaires, and so on. Once a good approximation or good idea of what the market is like is obtained, the production constraints may now be introduced. Maybe they were introduced at the beginning, but you put the two curves together is what it amounts to. Production constraint is the relationship of the cost to the production volume, and you tack on the profit and other items that you need to tack on. So this becomes a second curve of price versus quantity. Where a product has low elasticity, the two curves will intersect, usually at a single best quantity, which may establish sales goals. You may crank in some other things. Where the elasticity is high, there may be some volume which is practical, but But it's possible that no one will be willing to pay the lowest price at which the product can be profitably produced. And it's conceivable that the quantity that you can sell is simply too small. In other words, the curves don't intersect. Why didn't somebody tell me about this before I went into business?
You've reached the end of side one. To continue, stop your cassette player, turn over the cassette, and restart your machine.